Well, guys, thank you so much all for taking time to join. And thank you, Chike, for giving me an opportunity to present, talk about multifamily tonight. I know some of the folks in this group are experienced syndicator or experienced active investors, but there may be some folks who are a little less experienced. So this presentation is geared towards taking care of both the scenarios. So let's get started. Once again, my name is Prashant Kumar. I'm the president of Multifamily Realty Gains. And, I live here in Long Island, but in year 2019, we were doing very good. We had done deals in about 1,200 units in 2019 alone. But this year so far, we are a little bit, like everybody else, we are a little bit behind. So having said that, the disclaimer, basically this material is only for entertainment purposes. Any recommendations being made here is only to be taken on the face value. Everybody assumes the risk. They need to consult their professional service providers for any decisions that they take. Again, my name is Prashant Kumar. I talked about myself a little bit. I've been in the industry for almost 25 years, but in real estate, I started my career about 5 years ago. And because of my technology background, I'm able to do a lot of things in real estate, a lot of technical stuff, analyzing the deals. I have done JVs, I have done GPs. I own my own portfolio of about 100 units. So basically, for real estate, what is that? What is the initial step, right? Initial step for real estate is finding the properties, right? I mean, for finding the properties, what do we do? The most important thing is your relationship with the brokers, right? You start calling brokers in the cities which you have selected for yourself. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about them. But then the cities that you have selected, we have to form our team, our team of property managers, team of GCs. If you know somebody local in that area, boots on the ground, we need to start building that, because that's a key component. The two components, syndication business, you have to have the relationship with the brokers and you have to have the relationship with your investors, right? And basically, it's a constant effort that you keep analyzing the properties, you keep submitting LOIs. And once you have a deal, you basically you structure the deal correctly. And then the step after that is loan qualification. So where do you find brokers? I think the best place to find brokers is LoopNet, right? I go to LoopNet only to find brokers, not for the property. You would go to the LoopNet and you will find basically brokers, and you will find the properties listed by small brokers. The reason we look for properties listed by small brokers is if you see the property listed by a big broker, chances are you're going to pay the premium. So go to the broker's website and try to connect with the principal broker, not with the folks who are under him. Typically, small brokers have a team of 4 or 5 people. They are semi-experienced people. So your job is to start connect with the principal of any small brokerage. And once you have once you have found the broker list, you go and subscribe to their listing through their websites, I typically like to say that, try to call one new broker every day, right? just follow one rule. If I call one broker a day, one new broker a day, how many brokers would I have? How many new brokers would I have called in a month? 20. I mean, if you are talking about city like Atlanta or city like Indianapolis, or I mean, for that matter, any city, Orlando, you know, Boston, or whatever is your area where you want to buy property. If you are, if you have 20 brokers in your list, and you are constantly having the contact with them, you know, you are going to find a property pretty soon. I mean, that's typically, there's no magic bullet to it, but you have to follow your steps. You have to be persistent. You have to be persistent. Without that, you know, we can end up spending a lot of time and not able to achieve the results, right? So fundamentally, you know, you continue to find brokers and start calling them. That's the real key. I mean, that's how I would tell my story, how I found people. I mean, how I found properties, which we'll talk. All right. So be confident when we talk to these brokers. The other thing is you have to set a budget aside. If you are a new syndicator, or forget about syndication, even if you want to buy a property for yourself, right? And you don't want, I mean, broker is one thing. Yes, you are going to buy property through broker. But in addition to that, I mean, there might be off-market properties that one can buy, right? And for that, what needs to be done? Some marketing needs to be done. You need to set some budget aside. You know, you have to subscribe to some data source. Basically, you find the data for the area that you are interested in, right? And your goal is to find properties. Maybe you look for free and clear properties, you know, contact the mailing companies basically send direct mailers. I mean, in my personal experience, the first apartment complex which I bought like that, you know, I have done marketing. I posted a small bright postcard. I never send the envelope. A letter in an envelope because nobody opens the envelope, right? Nobody has the time to open an envelope. So whatever information I want to print, I print on a piece of yellow, bright yellow postcard, you know, fluorescent postcard. And that postcard goes, invariably everybody looks at it, right? I mean, it takes 5 seconds. And during that time, if they have, you know, if the postcard has, I mean, if they have read it, sometimes they call, right? So one is your postcard. Second is, you know, hire somebody to make calls. If you have time, you make calls, basically. So your goal is to connect with these mom and pop owners. I'm not talking about bigger properties here. I'm talking about only small mom and pop owners so that, you know, we can buy, we can buy smaller properties. I mean, when I say smaller properties, it could be as much as, you know, 50, up to 50, 60 units, right? So this can be done easily. And not much of budget is required for that. You know, you probably would need maybe $500-$600 or maybe $1,000 worth of budget per month and try that out for a couple of months. Invariably, these are the techniques, they always work. You know, I mean, if you want to go more sophisticated, you know, then you are talking about Facebook ads, Google ads, and Messenger ads. And there you end up spending a little bit of money. Again, it all depends on the budget. But I mean, in past, these direct mailers and hiring the calling services companies, they work all the time. I mean, they always work. I mean, right now we are in a situation where a lot of sellers are kind of sitting tight. You know, if you are making calls, it's a good time to connect with them. Maybe they are not ready to sell, or maybe they are not, we are not ready to buy, but it's the time when we can connect with these sellers, you know. And the fundamental thing is to follow with your leads regularly. That's the real key.
So have you syndicated those 40 and 50 unit apartments, or are you not?
No, so it's really up to you, up to your cash flow. Whether I mean, it's up to how much you, what kind of deal do you want to do? I mean, are you going to do a JV here, or you are going to, if you have the money for down payment, I mean, is this something that you would like to buy? There are a couple of things that you can do, okay? One is you can buy it for yourself, or you can have the JV partners, or you can do the syndication. For, I mean, as we have discussed many times, doing the syndication for a smaller property doesn't make sense, right?
It doesn't. I mean, that's really what I was asking. So you and Ed are not syndicating 40 and 50 unit buildings.
40 and 50 units, you know, the cost of doing the syndication itself is so high. You know, you're talking about $20,000-$30,000 just to do the paperwork for syndication. Okay. And it's not worth, I mean, if it is more than, you know, if you are buying a property worth 5 million, I mean, it depends, you know, if you're buying 40 units somewhere in New Jersey, that might be, you know, 7, 8 million, that you can do the syndication. It's not about the number of units, it's the price of the property.
Okay.
Right? If it is less than 5 million, maybe it is not worth doing the syndication.
Got it.
Right? All right. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how do you find your proper cities? I mean, there are a couple of rules of thumb that I have implemented myself for my search for cities when I was small. Now things have changed. I mean, small in the sense is when I was starting. Now I'm doing the syndication, so I look for different criterias, but typically I would look for properties which have grown anywhere from 10 to 20%. Anywhere from 10 to 20%, you know, typical rule is if the population of MSA is greater than 1 million, I would look for at least 10% growth. And that's how we get the, you know, property. You can type it in Google and Google can give you the growth in the population of a city very easily. You know, anywhere from 10 to 20%, that works best. And if you look for the medium income growth, there are various websites, you know, City Data is a good site. The medium income growth is at least 30%. Medium household prices have grown at least 40%. And it's not in 1 year, right? It's ever since 2000. The City Data gives the data from 2000 to 2000. Now I think it is going up to 2017. So that's how you would look at, you know, population growth, medium income growth, medium household prices, right? The crime rate is an important factor. You know, it has to be below 500 in City Data. You know, your job growth, you know, should be good. I think job growth is, I forgot, more than 5% or something. I'll have to look into that, what was the real number. But the job growth you can find from Department of Numbers, and then you have the state should be landlord friendly state. You can go to landlordstations.com, and price to rent ratio that you can get from smartassets.com, anywhere from 15 to 23%, right? So these are some rule of thumbs for us to pick the cities where we want to invest in. I mean, are we investing in you know, bigger MSAs like Atlanta or Orlando or you know, some of these big cities like Cincinnati or in Colorado, you know, Denver? It all depends. You know, what is that you are you looking to invest in primary markets, secondary market, or tertiary markets? That's a whole separate discussion that we can have. But even if you are going into secondary and tertiary markets, I would definitely look for certain attributes. Without that, I would not select any data, any city. As a general rule of thumb, I do not look for a city where I don't find a circle of highway. You know, I don't invest in a city where I have only plus sign for the highways, one going east to west and one going north to south. I don't invest in those places. At least it is as big that it has some, you know, it has a circular, you know, ring road around the city. So that's typically my rule of thumb, which I have not seen anybody talking about. But until I see that, I don't invest in that area. Bunch of other resources, you know, as I said, smartassets.com, you know, price to rent ratio. You can find landlord friendly state in landlord station. Then Zillow gives you the trend, you know, basically home values. Department of Numbers gives you job growth. So all of these websites have their own ranking. So whenever you are looking for cities where you want to invest in, you should always just, it takes 5 minutes to look at all of them at once, right? I mean, Tulia, Zillow, Yardie Metrics, Realtor.com, Forbes, apartment list. So, I mean, it takes about 5-10 minutes for one to just go through all these resources which are freely available for us on the internet. Fundamental thing is if you are seeing the rent growth, it means it is cash flow. And if you're looking for, you know, price growth in any area, it means it is good for appreciation. We're not talking about COVID and impact of COVID. You know, as I said, you know, there are some paid contents also, housingalerts.com, localmarketmonitor.com, Yardie Metrics. And it doesn't cost too much. You know, if you are actively looking for deals, it's better that one should subscribe to these for a couple of months at least. And when you are done looking into, if you have done enough research in that market or neighborhoods, then you can unsubscribe them. I'm talking from the perspective of newcomers, sort of new active investors, as well as those who are very active, you know, larger syndicators, they don't care about, you know, how much does it cost, because these deals are worth, these deals are worth multi-million, these for $1,500, they don't matter. Yes, these presentations will be sent out. When you look at the Zillow, you are looking for the trend, right? I mean, you are looking at the trend in the area. How are the house prices? How are the income? So if the house prices are stagnant, so to say, there are certain markets, certain tertiary markets, where house prices have not gone, or as a matter of fact, they have gone down. So you don't want to look at them, those areas. So basic idea is to feel whether this area has been growing or not, right? I mean, if you talk about Birmingham and Alabama, right? I mean, I haven't seen the prices going up in that area. So, and the population is decreasing. I mean, there are deals that have come across our table, but we have not paid attention to them, those are the non-growing, not, there hasn't been much growth over the last 20 years. I mean, what are the chances that those areas will grow further? So yeah, basically somebody asked me, are we looking for 20% population growth in a city of 1 million or more? No, for a city where the population is more than a million, we are looking for 10% growth over last 15 years. If it is less than a million, then general rule of thumb is approximately 20%. So, I'm moving a little faster because of the time. So for somebody, they say, what is a high cap rate? Is a high cap rate better or a lower cap rate? And the answer is, it depends. You know, if you are, and again, it is about somebody who wants to buy an asset for themselves. Typically, syndicators would not look at 14 cap property at all. I mean, 14 cap or 11 cap properties. But if you are looking to buy a small portfolio of row houses or 25, unit property or something, and somebody says, I'm giving you this property package and the cap rate is 24. Yes, it is 24, but are you going to like that? I mean, the chances are it's a D-class asset. You know, whatever money you are going to put in, that will all be lost. So do not worry about such properties. It is just an example. If the market is 8-cap market or 6-cap market, and somebody is giving you an asset at 15 cap or 18 caps or some ridiculous number, it's best that you run away, you know, from that, right? I mean, there's nothing, nobody's going to give you anything for free. Chances are you probably will not even get your rent back, monthly rent from those deals. So, you know, typically syndicators don't look at, that those higher cap rates at all. I mean, because any fluctuation of cap rate, even half, 50 basis point is good enough, from entry to exit. If it is a value add deal, you're talking 14 cap, we would not even worry about them. So yeah, basically CoStar and Axiometrix will give you, market and sub-market reports. When you are talking to these brokers, a lot of information you can achieve, you can find, you can get from the brokers, right? So you don't have to sign up for CoStar or Yardimetrics or Axiometrix. You know, once you start talking to the broker and you have built a relationships, broker will provide you all that information. Because these are expensive subscriptions. I don't know the exact price, but anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000. And if you are the beginner or sort of an intermediate investor, you really don't need to have these subscribed basically for individual usage. All right, so I talked a little bit about how to find the cities and what to do basically. Once you have established your city list, and then you do a little bit of marketing and you start calling brokers and submitting LOIs. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the syndication steps that we do. If you have found a property, maybe 5 million plus, that's, I think that's a fair number, 5 or 8 million plus if you want to do syndication. So basically, we'll talk a little bit about that. Everything starts from what is your objective? Are you an active investor or passive investor, right? Somebody is asking a question, can you spend a minute on what the benefit of lower cap market may be for the entities that are less familiar with the cap rate? So basically, what is a cap rate, right? Cap rate is a characteristic that defines the growth in the market, right? If it is a competitive market, you are looking for lower cap rate properties. It means the property prices are higher or elevated, right? So about a year ago or 2 years ago, the cap rates were a little bit on the higher side, anywhere from 8 to 9. But as the market kept on increasing, the cap rates started falling down. I mean, they have been falling down for last so many years. But let's take an example of Atlanta, right? If you are buying a property in Atlanta, the cap rate, you are talking about cap rate anywhere from 5.5 to 6.5, depending upon which neighborhood you are buying, anywhere from 5 to 6.5, something like that, right? It means that this is a market which has grown, which has seen significant growth over a period of time, and there is demand, right? I mean, there was time when now broker is not even publishing the whisper price. I mean, they are just saying, expected prices depending upon market. So there was a bidding war going on to get into the property. So the lower cap rate markets are the ones where the prices have gone up considerably, and it has become very difficult for beginners or syndicators to get into those deals and still justify higher returns for their investors. In a high cap market, can be your D class neighborhood, D minus class here neighborhood, where you have, you know, 50 unit building, but nobody pays the rent. I mean, you are almost calculating cap rate on pro forma only. In reality, you never get your rent back from those tenants. So you are saying that, yes, I have 50 units, you know, $1,000 per unit, you are talking about $50,000 worth of cash flow coming every month. And somebody will say, oh, my expense ratio is only 5%. Not true. I mean, that doesn't happen. So lower cap rate means, you know, more stabilized assets, and the market has seen enough growth, and there is much more competition to get into those assets, whether it is individual purchase or JV or syndication. So any more questions, feel free to ask me. But on syndication steps, and as I said, you know, if we are new, typically we say that it's better that we invest with somebody. I mean, let's say I'm a doctor, right? Or I'm a, you know, lawyer or attorney. I don't want to buy anything for myself. Maybe I will be a passive investor. And it is easy for passive investor. There are a bunch of people, there are a bunch of deals out there. They can vet the syndicator out and then they can invest with them. But we are not talking about passive investors today. So we're just talking about active investors, those who want to buy property for themselves, manage themselves. I mean, manage themselves means have the property manager and manage those assets, or do JV or do syndication. So let's keep moving. So basically, as I said, you know, we talked about, you gather all the data about the location, the price range that you want to buy the property in. And the important thing is now you have to identify a role that you want to play in a deal, right? I mean, we have talked many, many times in many, many calls, is if you are a newbie or, you know, you are not complete full-fledged sponsor of a deal and you are looking to buy something or you want to do some active investment, maybe it is better that you narrow down the area that you can focus on, you know, become the equity partner on a deal, or, you know, bring the deal to the table, or bring the whole deal to the closure, get the contract signed. So the bunch of things that you can do in a deal. So you identify a role basically for yourself, gather all that information, have that information at one place. As I said, you know, you already talked to many brokers, you are introducing yourself basically. And the important thing is now you are already starting to talk to the local banks or credit unions or the finance brokers also. At the same time, if I'm looking for property, let's say in Indianapolis, right? I probably would like to, number one, survey that area. Number two, I would like to talk to local banks or credit unions, depending upon what kind of property I'm buying. If I'm buying it for myself, I would just go to the local banks, which typically don't give the loan so easily to the out-of-state owners. But in some cases, maybe they can too, if you go through a referral. So most important thing, again, as I said, you know, talking to the brokers and submitting LOIs, okay? I typically believe in a framework, 3 hours a day for 3 months, you know, 3 hours a day for 3 months and talking to one new broker a day. I mean, most likely you'll have anywhere from 20 to 40 brokers in an area. And if you're spending three, four hours a day and you're submitting LOIs, then, I mean, 2-3 LOIs a week, chances are that you will end up having a deal in 3 to 4 months. Again, we are not talking about COVID or anything for how long we need to wait and all that. That's a separate discussion and we can talk about that. But right now we are just assuming that the market is good enough and just general guidelines, you know. So you are looking for local banks, credit unions. You are talking to your general contractors, PM companies, Once you have the property, you know, you are analyzing. The important thing is, if you're talking to new brokers and a broker has sent you the property, the important thing for you is to analyze that deal as soon as possible. Don't sit on it and send your underwriting file back to the broker and ask for his opinion. Now you have gotten broker's attention that you are serious. Typically, brokers have a tough time trusting new contacts until they see the seriousness. And if you show, I mean, that's just an example. You know, if you have broker sends you a property and you respond back right away in a day, then it, broker knows that, you know, you are serious or somewhat serious, and you're asking for opinion. You can review your underwriting with the broker, to build that contact with him. So, as I said, you know, every time you're talking to your folks, you know, you keep making notes, basically date and time wise, that way, you know, time will come that you will start forgetting things. You know, your CRM has to be good enough where you are making these notes, or, whichever way you are making notes, you know, Excel spreadsheet, CRM, or, you know, paper notebooks are no good anymore. I mean, even though I do spend time on paper notebooks, but the challenge is how to find the information in future. I don't like paper notebook anymore. So yeah, some basic stuff, you know, you're talking to the PM companies in that area, broker, banks, local, local property managers. And if possible, you talk to the tenant also when you do the walkthrough, or you talk to the tenants in the community. Basically, but I mean, that will happen. Actually, this is the wrong step. It will happen after the LOI and maybe after during the due diligence. But once the LOI is acknowledged, then you are asking for, by that time you should, if before LOI you did not have offering memorandum, T12 or rent roll, the moment LOI is accepted, you should ask for that information, because that is the information that you will need to do the underwriting for your deal. So analyze the numbers. Basically, then you are visiting your property along with your property manager, construction companies. These are very important steps. Going a little bit faster. So good thing is that when you are looking at a property, you have to analyze the appearance. You know, how is the quality of neighborhood? Is this something that you are comfortable getting into? Because if it is a C-minus kind of area, and your property is all almost C-class property, then improving that property to B-class will not give you the bang for your bucks. So it's not just the property, it's the area, neighborhood, that is needed to be looked at, right? So some basic stuff here. I'm not going to talk too much about these. In general, we look at the roofing, you know, parking, curb appeal, you know, utilities, what kind of utilities we have, you know, water, gas, electricity, you know, check the entrance, you know, go around, drive around the property, you know, and then ask for comparables for the property. What are the comps in that area? Because that is an important piece of information. Whether you find it yourself from paid data sources, or you ask your broker to give the comps, because you want to compare what is the rent per square feet for the other comparable properties today, or when you would, at the time of exit, are they comparable or not? So drive around the neighborhood, basically. And again, research, you know, how much can you research about your deal? It all depends, you know, how big of a property it is, but you have to do your rigorous underwriting. Without that, that your rigorous underwriting, you know, basically, and then you review your underwriting with the broker too. So yeah, you review your underwriting with the broker, and then you do the counter, and then you discuss with the owners, basically. So, and in the end, you basically secure a contract. Once you have discussed the deal with the seller or with the broker, then you go into the contract. Once you have gotten into the contract, you know, there are a lot of steps. You know, that's when the real work starts. All the due diligence, you know, engaging the property manager who will do the due diligence, you know, then you are talking to the financing options, you know, you are talking to the finance broker, you know, local banks or the credit unions, and you are negotiating with them also. You are not just negotiating with, you are actually negotiating with a lot of people at that time. You are negotiating with your finance broker, local banks, credit unions, you are negotiating with, you know, your broker, you are negotiating with the seller also, because that, I mean, still things going on. I mean, towards the end of the period, you know, when you want an extension, things like that, there some discussions go on with the seller. But that's a lengthy process. I mean, this is just a lengthy process. I mean, we can discuss about it. Depending upon the kind of deal you are. If it is an opportunistic deal, chances are this is going to be a long-term effort before you close it, right? It depends, you know, what is your backing. So we can discuss all that, but again, it comes with the experience. And if you are getting into some deal like that, and if you are a newbie, I mean, and not to discourage anybody, but learn to walk before you start thinking of running. Either you have a coach or a mentor, or give the deal to somebody and play a smaller role in the deal. So that's something, just a word of caution from me. So from LOI to a contract, somebody's asking how long can it take before you get to contract? So, I mean, if you are submitting LOIs, from LOI to contract can be a 2 weeks time period. I mean, you can, it all depends how fast you do your work. You do your underwriting clearly. You talk to the, you know, you look at the property, do all these things. What we just talked about, it can be as little as a week. In some cases, you know, it could be much lesser if you already knew the asset. But I would say, as a precaution, 1 week to 2 weeks is normal. Can it be more? It can be more also, but again, it depends. But I would say 2 weeks maybe is a reasonable amount of time from LOI to contract. And if you are in a bridge situation, you know, you are talking about construction budget, right? I mean, broker will ask for the construction budget, and that would need a lot of work. You know, you need to have the GC and PM involved, because all that needs to be underwritten, right? And you need to get the construction quotes from GC or from the property manager, if property manager is playing the part of the construction manager. So all that needs to be decided. So it's, and if you're in a bid situation, 2 weeks is not going to be sufficient, most likely. But again, it depends on the deal. If it is more opportunistic deal, then that duration could be more. If it is more of a stable asset or a light value add, then maybe 2 weeks would be sufficient. So continue to refine your budget, because, you know, you are talking to the bridge lenders, right? And they will continue to refine. They will continue to review your budget until they'll continue to prepare their package until they submit their package to the committee for approval, right? So your underwriting is an ongoing process for the duration of the contract. So, I mean, we can talk about a lot about this. There are a lot of steps involved. You know, you are talking about environmental, you are talking about the appraisal, you know, lead paint, study, things like that. But we can talk about these, but in general, it's a lengthy process, right? So once the broker has submitted, has done Once the lender has done the, environmental appraisal, lead paint study, etc., broker, lender submits the, prepares the package, and then they submit that package for committee. They get the final approval. So while we were doing all this, the moment we had LOI approved, that's when we start creating the pitch deck for our investors, right? I mean, we don't start the pitch deck for our investors when you have the final approval on the loan. Because you are assuming that, we will get the loan because, getting your investors. So property is one thing. Second thing is investors. They should be worked together almost parallelly. So you had your pitch deck, you had to, you were starting to have webinars, soft commitments, you were deciding whether it's going to be 506B or C, who's going to sign on your loan. And all this needs to be reviewed. It takes just so much time, and every time you present information to your investors and it gets changed until the final approval of the rate and terms from your, from your lender. So there's just too many things. You have to have the boots on the ground, collaborate with one or more construction companies who have done similar kind of projects. So all this keeps on going on. And at the same time, you are negotiating with everybody. It's like you are the master of negotiation art. You have to continue to invest a lot of time in negotiating with insurance broker, for that matter. you are negotiating with your finance broker. You are negotiating with your GCs, property man. You are negotiating with property manager. You are negotiating with the insurance broker. Lender is giving the insurance requirements. Those are being looked at the same. So it's a team effort. I mean, all I'm trying to say is that it is a team effort. You are working on your PPM, attorney, subscription agreement. And if you are the new person, you don't have any of the portals like IMS and things like that where things can be easier, you will be spending a lot of time trying to set it up in, DocuSign, and PPM is coming, subscription agreement is coming, who's doing the soft commitment, and all that. And it's better you start collecting the money sooner than near the closing date. So if you can, if your investors are ready, list goes on, basically. So it's better that you collect money from investors in escrow much before the closing date, because invariably what will happen is, you will have one or two investors who will be holding the deal, and you will be, and you will be basically lowballed invariably. If you are in deep soup, better if you have, very limited bandwidth, better try to get the money sooner from investors. Otherwise, typically, investors, depends on how much is your investor base. But if you're waiting till towards the end to collect the money, chances are you will be in trouble. So better. So these things, they go hand in hand, basically. They go parallel. So I think that's all I have for, general guidelines. Everybody has different guidelines on their syndication. If you have $3 million raise, in general, people allocate 30% of GP for the raise, right? It means out of 3 million, somebody is raising 10%. I mean, again, this cannot be done the way it is written. It is not a compensation based on the amount. it is something that has to be, equity partner has to be, equity partner is going to get that irrespective of the amount there is. That's how it should be done. If you try to do it based on the amount somebody is raising it and you give it, that is against the SEC rules. SEC has been tightening up. I mean, you have heard from many syndication attorneys that if you try to do that, that is against the law. So yeah, investor, you know, basically somebody who's, those who are raising money, they're not being called nowadays as money raisers. They are being called as equity partners, right? I mean, what is against the law? Somebody is asking, what is against the law? So the person who is raising the money, and if you are giving them percentage of GP based on the amount that they are raising, it means they are behaving as a equity broker without a license. It is equity broker's job to raise and get the commission on the amount of raise. Any individual, if he is raising the money and getting compensated based on the amount he is raising, is actually not being looked at a malpractice by SEC that we are trying to pay the commission without a broker license. So yeah, so what is loan? What is non-recourse loan? Okay, so non-recourse loan is a loan which is secured by the asset, right? I mean, in case property is not making, if in case we are not able to make the mortgage payment, non-recourse means bank is not coming after the syndicator or the sponsors, as long as bank cannot establish a bad boy clause. Non-recourse means your personal assets are at stake. If you are not able to pay the mortgage, bank will take over the property and then sell it. And if there's a difference, then bank will come after you. But in non-recourse, that's not the case, provided that bank is not able to prove gross negligence. It means that you have done what a sponsor has done, what they could have done to run the property smoothly, but they are still not able to produce enough cash flow. In that case, bank will take over the property and then they will try to put new management or try to sell it. But your personal assets are not at stake. That is what. But there's, there's a bad boy clause out. Also, if bank can establish that it was a matter of gross negligence, then that non-recourse can trigger the recourse also. I've not seen that happening because of my limited experience. I'm pretty sure folks have seen it and they talk about it. So you know, better be careful on that. So yeah, many times, you know, again, it depends on the deal. You know, you can offer anywhere from 5% to 10%, or sometimes people do offer 20% of GP for signing on the loan. I've not seen 20% anywhere, but in general, and analysis and the legal, you know, somebody who has brought the deal to the table and who has done all the work putting together all the package, they may get 5 to 10%, but that. These are just general guidelines, you know. It's not hard and fast. Everybody does their business in different ways. Asset management can be, 30% of the whole GP, and then, earnest money deposit, at risk money, the duration 4 or 5 months, if you are talking about $10 million property, you are talking about good, 200,000-300,000 people may end up asking for 10% of GP for putting that 10% at risk money.
We have a couple questions that came up in the chat. I don't know if we got
sure, Sure. Let's take care of them. Can you look for them?
So we have one question. Going back to the section around the LOIs and doing your underwriting, just wanted some clarification around that point as far as doing your underwriting and getting the T12 rent roll, etc., prior to sending out an LOI, and in what situations might.
Yeah. So I have seen certain sellers who do not want to give a lot of financials about the property beforehand. I've seen that kind of situation happening many times. But if the property is coming to us via broker, then most likely we will have offering memorandum, T12 and rent roll. And we should have done our underwriting before we submit the LOI, right? I mean, that is something that we should do even before we submit the LOI. If we did not have enough financials, LOI is a non-binding agreement in which you are expressing your interest at around certain price. That kind of gives some sentiment from the seller that seller is willing to sell approximately at this price. If you did not have all the necessary documents, you probably cannot do underwriting properly, but you will submit an LOI. Once the LOI gets submitted, you'll get these documents, and then you will get all those documents. You will do the underwriting basically. But most likely, I mean, those documents are available, and it's better that you do your underwriting before submitting the LOI.
Question, this one is more as opinionated about markets and kind of going back to the questions about cap rates. Okay. So this individual is looking at several cities to invest in: Chicago, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Florida, and Massachusetts.
Okay.
So do you have any sort of insights or any advice that you might be able to give them?
I know the way the market is right now, and we were not talking about it because we are very close to a long-term recession, and we don't know where would it be. What at least we are doing is we are holding any decisions to buy right now, but we are looking at the areas where the property values have not gone too high, right? I mean, there are a lot of markets Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Indianapolis, where prices have not gone to the level where, you know, like cities like Atlanta or Orlando. So if you are pressed to buy something, you buy in an area where the prices have been more stable and they do not get impacted by recession too much. So you have to kind of compare last 8 to 10 years worth of historical data in terms of the property prices, medium income. But I mean, right today, if I have to buy a property, I would be very cautious. You know, I mean, I'm sure people are doing a lot of deals, but I mean, with my discussions with a lot of brokers, you know, they say there are a lot of buyers who are delaying their decision to buy something. So Connecticut, Cincinnati, I mean, Cincinnati is a good market, don't take me wrong, but it has gone up so high. You know, Columbus, Ohio has gone up so high. Unless I buy something at 75 cents on a dollar today, I'm not gonna buy anything, you know, because we have seen the research from Green Street Advisor, and there are many, many research out there, you know. You type it, there is a slump, you know, prices are starting to come down. I mean, I wouldn't buy even at 90% valuation, you know. So that's just my opinion. I mean, I'm not forcing my opinion. Thank you so much for your time.